It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. So more than two decades removed from his long tenure at the State Department of Natural Resources, George Meyer still has a read on conservation policy, and we recognize that. We want to discuss policy with perspective from a 30-year career at the DNR, including 11 years as secretary, starting under former Governor Tommy Thompson. Follow that up with 18 years leading the citizen conservation group called Wisconsin Wildlife Federation until retiring in 2021. Call in with your questions about environmental policy affecting our state's natural resources through time, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. George Meyer, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much for having me, Kate.
How is the policy focus of the groups that you worked with and headed up different today than in the past?
Well, I think right now there's still a lot of citizen engagement through organizations such as Wisconsin Wildlife Federation and other environmental conservation groups. They often now, our focus, unfortunately, has been to try to preserve the protection and the policies that protect and enhance natural resources. When I started, it was really an exciting age. Many laws were just coming on board: Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act, Stewardship Law was coming on. So it was a time of expansion and good, solid funding for conservation. Has changed substantially these days.
Was it easier or more difficult to affect change? I mean, to find consensus on conservation policy initiatives in the past?
It was. And, and I started in the 1970s and was at DNR up until 2000. There was a good consensus among the almost the full political spectrum and political parties of the importance of conservation and environmental protection. The citizens have always had, and still to this day, have a very strong majority that are very support those activities, whether it be managing species or protecting water quality and air quality. But in fact, over time, there's been a political divide over those issues. Funding for political campaigns by interest groups has played a major role in striking this divide in many times between the parties. That doesn't mean there aren't individual legislators on both sides that want to work, but the leadership tends to be more divisive on conservation environmental issues.
One thing that is so front and center in our environment now is PFAS, the legacy of these human-made chemicals, forever chemicals, just turning up in wells all over. What further steps should the state be taking to address PFAS pollution?
That's an excellent, very timely question. And it's important to sportsmen that I represented for many years, because now there's fish advisors were in many bodies of water, finding up in the Great Lakes, where people can't eat or have to restrict their diet of fish that are harvested. But obviously the major threat these days is to people's drinking water in many spots throughout the state. Our state has fallen behind other states, the neighboring states, Minnesota, Michigan, that have provided leadership. And there's been strong lobbying efforts restricting the Department of Natural Resources from doing its job under the law to implement proper standards and implement those standards to reduce and clean up PFAS in the environment. It's called a forever chemical. It stays there forever. So you need to restrict putting into the environment to start with, and you have to get it out of the environment because it continues to spread through the groundwater. It doesn't just stay under one property. It spreads out to neighbors' homes or businesses.
From your viewpoint, who should pay for the cleanup and, you know, resolving this legacy pollution?
Well, the policy in this country and in this state has been what's known as polluter pays. And basically, those responsible should take the lead, or their insurance companies should take the lead cleaning up. That's been the policy in this country for over 50 years. Now, many of these, at times, the business can't afford it or has actually gone out of business. In those situations, the taxpayer ends up funding it. And then that happens in many cases. So that's the trouble with this, because it gets more costly as PFAS spread through the waters, groundwaters and surface waters of the state.
We're talking about environmental conservation with George Meyer, former head of the Department of Natural Resources and the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. You can join in along the way on natural resources, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to climate change now. Governor Evers is expected to propose several initiatives to address climate change in his budget. What should be done to really tackle climate change in Wisconsin?
Well, the main thing is to change how we heat our homes, how we fuel our vehicles, and reduce, and on a national level, keep on working with other countries, because this is a worldwide issue, and leverage other companies and be an example of how we need to restrict the emissions of CO2 and methane into the environment. And everybody can help out on this. A lot of it is energy efficiency, making sure you're using energy efficient devices, insulating your homes. But then we need to support the transition to wind and solar, and in my opinion, safe nuclear, to in fact get away from fossil fuel use. It has an impact on the environment. Sportsmen know that, because we are outdoors a lot and have seen the increase in temperature and the impact on seasons and species over the last 50 years. The change in terms of precipitation. I live in southern Wisconsin. We've been getting many more frequent heavy storms, which cause erosion problems, water quality problems. So we have to stem the increase and start cutting back on CO2 emissions.
When did the conversations in government and in conservation groups happen in your time? I mean, how is climate change more of a consideration of policymakers now compared to when you were DNR secretary?
Well, it's interesting. When I was secretary in the 1990s, myself and as secretary of Wisconsin DNR and other environmental agency leaders throughout the state were having that kind of discussion. And we're getting educated at that time about it. It was really a new concept. The public was not as involved, but I can tell you with the Department of Natural Resources at that time was leading the nation in terms of educating the public in Wisconsin and also supporting energy efficiency measures, working collectively with our utilities, who were in fact very open to doing that because it also had positive economic impacts for them. It became later, about 15 years ago, it became another one of these divisive partisan issues, often fueled by the energy industry and largely in the oil and gas era, and politicians in other states that are largely funded, their campaigns funded by those interests. So it became sort of a darker period and became something that was almost, dangerous, not dangerous, but difficult to make progress on from a policy standpoint.
When it was politicized.
Now I think the public has broken through that.
Okay.
And the politicians are starting to get more and more, and there are more programs being developed. But we lost a lot of important time in dealing with the issue, and it made it more difficult and costly to deal with it because of that lag in time.
George Meyer is a longtime Wisconsin conservation advocate, former DNR leader, reflecting on current conservation policies, the direction of environmental work in our state. Colin, with your questions along the way, your observations about natural resource issues, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Former DNR Chief George Meyer has witnessed decades of conservation policy and environmental protections in Wisconsin. And in a more recent era, as we've been talking about, watched an agency trying to navigate and respond to the climate crisis. Call in with your questions, comments about Wisconsin's natural resources, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Diane in Iron County. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I was just at a meeting yesterday about the turtle flambeau flowage, and parks are supposed to be self-sustaining, and there is no money to take care of this jewel of the north. They were saying that in Minnesota, the state pays about $11 per visitor to all their parks, state parks. In Wisconsin, it was something like either $1.50 or $1.80 per person is spent on resources for people visiting parks. We don't have wardens or rangers that are patrolling the waters to make sure people aren't over-harvesting. There isn't enough money to take care of the campsites. They're asking for volunteers. It's terrible.
Diane, thank you for bringing that to the table. And George, what do you hear in Diane's thoughts about the dollars going into maintenance and efforts to keep, you know, the turtle flambeau flowage within the conservation boundaries?
I'm glad Diane raised this issue. And it's, while it clearly is happening at the turtle flambeau flowage, it's happening at many properties throughout the state. The state has really lagged in funding maintenance of the properties. There is support, obviously, for land acquisition. But when you do that, you have to fund taking care of it. So you really are good stewards of land. I'll give you a number. When I was working, in fact, at the time I was secretary, there were 3,000 employees in the Department of Natural Resources. Now it's 2,500, which is a major loss. And that was in the 1990s. And the responsibilities have grown, and both in terms of land to manage, but also the complexity, the size, the new environmental programs that have developed in the last 30 years. We need to put more funding onto the land in management for our purposes. Developing efficient ways of reducing pollution, do more outreach and education with citizens. So Diane, you're correct. Minnesota has really gone past us. We used to be ahead of them on most of these issues. They've surpassed us tremendously. Michigan has surpassed us also.
Let's go to Bruce now in Dodgeville. Bruce, hi, what's on your mind?
Hello?
Hi, yes, go ahead.
Hi, George. My name is Bruce Calhoun. I think we have a mutual friend, Tom Hoggy, who also worked in the DNR for many years. But what I wanted to talk to you about is taking a deeper dive on nature-based climate solutions, not only in Wisconsin, but as you mentioned, worldwide. I work a lot with forests in the tropics, and as you know, there's probably about 200 tons of carbon per acre in the rainforest, and all that goes into the atmosphere when we burn it down. And the thing about nature-based climate solutions, and you'll probably agree with this is something we can do almost immediately, and it can be a bridge to where we want to get to in 2050 with a completely clean energy grid.
Bruce, thank you. And George, I want to just bring you in here on, using forests to address climate change.
Yeah, and it's not just forests, but that's obviously a major way of uptake and tying up carbon. And if used properly, not releasing it or release smaller amounts of it ultimately. And it's just good land management. And it has benefits beyond climate. It has benefits in terms of job creation, in terms of logging and helping our paper industry in the state. But also agriculture can play a major role. How farmers manage their lands and through that end up tying up carbon within the soil, where it is not released and emitting carbon into the environment. Land management, forestry, agriculture can play a major role, and it is positive in terms of economics and not necessarily costly. Government can help, for instance, educate landowners, private landowners, so land stays in private land ownership on how to do it, may provide some initial subsidies cross, which are very common, especially in agriculture, in terms of cost sharing, and get farmers started, and obviously help landowners in terms of forest management.
What about the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund? I mean, as you talk about land management, the fund created in 89 under Governor Tommy Thompson and the legislature. What is the legacy?
Well, and I had the privilege and honor to, when I was secretary, to sign off on the acquisition of 150,000 acres of land bought under the stewardship program, representing the dedicated professionals and DNR and willing landowners in the state. It provides, really is, they're not creating more land, and to make sure we have water quality, we have public access to lands for hunting, recreation, and other recreational pursuits, from snowmobiling to hiking to bird watching, fishing.
Governor Evers.
It's critically important, not just in terms of, go ahead.
I was going to just jump in here because Governor Evers wants to rescind a law that allows members of the legislature to anonymously block a stewardship project, and that surfaced yesterday in the Associated Press. Should lawmakers be required to object publicly?
I think whether or not you're conservationist or not, I think most citizens say, fine, the legislature does have can ultimately control of the purse, but vote on it publicly. Let people know if you've got an issue, and sometimes they're legitimate issues. Oftentimes they're not, but object publicly and then have a committee, have a hearing, let the public come in and weigh in on their perspective, and then vote on it publicly. The lack of transparency on how stewardship gets tied up in the Joint Finance Committee is against democracy, as far as I'm concerned, and the principles of democracy. And I think most people, citizens, don't like secret government, which that really is. And I think the governor is right on this. I don't think this should be a conservative or liberal issue. It should be just a good civic government issue.
George, we are almost out of time, but in retirement, are you able to spend more time enjoying public lands?
I do. I really, I love getting outdoors. We've got a young grandson, our first, and as he gets older, he's going to be spending a lot of time outdoors with his grandma and grandpa and his mom and dad, I can tell you that. He's destined.
George, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Kate.
George Meyer is former secretary of the DNR, past executive director of the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, and remains on the board of the federation. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore a statewide prison art exhibit curated by the Portrait Society Gallery of Contemporary Art. It's called Art Against the Odds, and it's on display at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. Join in on inmate artists, their creations, their place in the art world, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jeff Morin is president of the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. Jeff, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. We also have Deborah Bramer with us, director of the Portrait Society Gallery of Contemporary Art and exhibit curator. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, Deborah, let's start with you. What are you hoping people experience by viewing artwork from current and former incarcerated individuals?
I guess underlying emphasis of the exhibition is to showcase the humanity of incarcerated individuals who are often hidden from society. So we hope that people who visit the show will come away a little bit surprised by the quality of the work and the uniqueness of the work and the variety of individuals making art in prison.
Jeff, what thoughts and questions do you want to have people percolating, you know, stewing on in their mind when they walk through the exhibit?
I think one of the most important things for people to be thinking about when they view the exhibit is that this is evidence about how basic the driving need to make or create is for humans. Many of the artists have shared that their art allows them to express their humanity. It allows them to develop empathy and self-awareness and to have a sense of self outside of their criminal record.
Yes, an identity outside their crime. Deborah, in choosing pieces for this exhibit, what did you think about? How did you go about curating?
Well, this was a COVID project. My gallery is a contemporary art gallery. It's a commercial gallery. But about 6 years ago, we added a program called On the Wing, which receives nonprofit status through a fiscal receiver. And the intention of that project was to get beyond the Third Ward where the gallery's located and make connections to other parts of the city and other types of people who may not have access to as much art programming or art experiences. So we did that project for 4 years at the House of Peace, which is a hub of community services. And there I had kind of a awakening, I guess you could call it, and now it seems almost a little naive, but a topic at our table, while we were doing this drawing practice at the House of Peace, was so frequently prison life. You know, there are people, women had, you know, their sons were in prison, their husbands, men who came to the table were often had served time, and I really realized how pervasive this is, how it affects the city. And if you live in a Black neighborhood, or if you're an African-American individual, chances are, you know, one out of 36 Black individuals are imprisoned in Wisconsin. It's actually the highest rate of anywhere in the country. So when COVID closed down our program, it felt like this might be worthwhile to explore. What's going on in the prisons, of course, through the window of the art world, because I'm an art curator. And to find the artists, we partnered with someone named Shannon Ross. He's formerly incarcerated.
Oh, sure. We've had him on our program.
Shannon?
Yes, yes, we do.
Everybody knows Shannon. While he was in, he founded a newsletter to circulate in the prisons. And since he's been out, he's amplified that newsletter. And that's how we reached out into the prisons. We put notices in the community, it's called, and asking for individuals to respond if they were interested in showing their work. And we received a surprising number of responses almost immediately.
Hmm. Jeff, is there a particular piece of art that really speaks to you that you connected with on a deeper level in this exhibit?
Well, I think in the broader context, it's a powerful exhibition because most of those included are self-taught. And they're working with such a limited range of found materials, materials like toothpicks, milk cartons, paper, snack wrappers, even dissolved antacid tablets for color.
Hmm.
So one piece that resonated the most with me because of its ambition is a 5-foot-tall working Ferris wheel model that's made from rolled-up computer paper, cardboard gears, string, a shampoo bottle, and a sand mechanism that keeps the Ferris wheel moving for about 10 minutes.
Oh, wow.
It's an amazing piece of engineering.
Wow. What about for you, Deborah? What speaks to you in this exhibit and how you put these pieces together?
Oh, so many. The works are just incredibly impressive and accomplished. But I'm continuously struck when I walk into the gallery by the work of Dominic Merrick, who did pencil drawings of some fellow inmates, very beautifully rendered. And then he translated those drawings into collages using junk food wrappers and soda wrappers. And they're very elegant collages that he says speak of the disposability of incarcerated individuals, how society views incarcerated individuals. So they're really beautiful. They're very touching.
Do you know anything about when inmates normally are able to create art when they are in a prison facility? How does that access and time work? Because artists need time to create.
Well, incarcerated individuals do have time. I mean, not to make light of that, but there's very little to do when you're in prison. It's boring. Days go slowly. They're marked by, you know, when is the yard open? When are the phones open? When do we eat? When is my time to have a library privilege? So there is a lot of time. How artists make art in prison and where depends on the security level of the prison, of course. Some are able to make work in their cells. Some have to go to a hobby room. Materials are limited. If you have money, you can order art materials through a catalog, a prison-approved catalog. The materials are often a little substandard, but they are available. In most prisons, you are able to declare two hobbies, let's say beading and painting. And then you are able to order those materials through the catalog. But some artists, such as Joshua Gressel, did not have access to materials. And he ended up ripping up his milk cartons and juice cartons and creating hundreds of these little figures and creatures that became very important to him. Even though he would get in trouble for ripping up the milk cartons, because milk cartons are state property, state goods, and you're not allowed to utilize state goods, he had to keep doing it. So in the show, we have a large wall of maybe 100 of these milk monsters, as he called them.
Mm. Curator Deborah Bramer directs the Portrait Society Gallery of Contemporary Art. Jeff Morin leads MIAD, the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, where Art Against the Odds is on display. Join in by calling with your questions, your comments. Share what comes up for you about artists who are incarcerated. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about this exhibition called Art Against the Odds, Wisconsin Prison Art, on display in Milwaukee, and the conversation it elevates about our criminal justice system and inmate expression through artwork. Still time for your questions, your perspective, 800-642-1234. We have Portrait Society Gallery of Contemporary Art Director Deborah Bramer with us, and Jeff Morin, who leads the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. Jeff, I want to turn to you for a moment here to talk about solitary confinement and, you know, behavior related to solitary confinement. How does this exhibit address solitary?
We do have, as part of the layout of the exhibition, a footprint for a solitary confinement cell. And that gives the attendees of the exhibition an idea of the limited space that somebody occupies when they're in solitary confinement.
Mm. You have a lot of students, you know, in your building as well. What are their thoughts on this exhibit?
Well, I think one of the important things for us is that our mission is to ignite curious minds through art, design, and service. And what this allows us, the conversation that we have with our students is around how we get to live out our institutional values of community, inclusion, and courage. One of the points that is resonating on campus is the fact that 95% of those incarcerated will eventually return to our communities. So we're really trying to foster conversations with our students that encourage reflection on incarceration, on the nature of rehabilitation, and on what the restorative power of art making can be.
Hmm. I want to bring in a voice here in the exhibit, former inmate Sarah Demarath. And here's Sarah talking with WTMJ-TV about her collection of abstract ink paintings in the exhibit.
The circles represent my eyes at different points of my addiction. And I had all these stories in this long 16-year battle with addiction. The only thing recognizable to me were my eyes at that point.
Deborah, what did you see in Sarah's artwork?
Sarah's artwork is just amazing, because if you're in the exhibition and you see it, it is a grid of abstract patterns made with alcohol. I think they're kind of their organic abstract patterns. Don't look like they're narrative at all. But then when you read the text, you'll see that while she was in prison, she was journaling and she was trying to make sense of and hold on to those 16 years of addiction. She didn't want to just put that behind her. She knew she had to process it. So when she got out of prison, she started making these compositions based on the journal entries. So each image represents a stage of her history and her addiction. Mm. So she found an incredible language to access all of this and then to share it.
I want to bring in a comment here. Julie in Sparta called in, and Julie says they used to live near the Minnesota State Fair, and the fair had a section in the art exhibit with art from inmates. And Julie would go every year because it was so interesting. And they say that the art was regular canvas paintings and not made out of found pieces or scraps, or what would be considered as, quote, prison art. Jeff, what are your thoughts on having more exposure and, more exposure through art exhibits like at a state fair?
Well, I think exposure to the work being created within within the prison system is powerful. It allows us all to have conversations about just the value of creation, the value of making, and our self-worth. What we're hearing from the participants in this exhibition is that they've learned empathy through their art making. They've learned self-awareness through their art making. For one of the participants, he refers to it as a tool for managing his mental health. And if it is not a formal part of the programming within the prison system, individuals will find a way to feed that very important basic part of being a human.
Talking with Jeff Morin, president of the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. Deborah Bramer is here, leads the Portrait Society Gallery of Contemporary Art, as we learn about this exhibit in Milwaukee featuring artwork by current and former inmates. So, Deborah, I want to ask you, is there an appetite for inmate artwork in the art world, collector's world, and the marketplace for art? I mean, is it valued and accepted and treated equally, or is it treated differently?
That's kind of a question that has both answers. It is treated differently too often. This kind of art is treated as other within the contemporary art world. It's not quite let in. It's thought of as outsider art, or therapeutic art, or something else, something other. And what we've done with the show, the very premise was to make sure that that didn't happen, because these individuals are already marginalized, and so we didn't want this like as kind of a add-on to the art world, in the art world, but something not quite of the art world. So all of the work is framed. It's professionally mounted. The exhibition is presented in six thematic sections. So it's an orderly path through. And I think more progress is being made in the contemporary art world to diversify and to not think of someone who is self-taught, someone who is poor, geographically remote, someone who is a woman, someone who is old, you know, all the previous ways that we discriminated in the art world are now being much more carefully examined. So this show fits right into, I think, this time period. And it really is important, because people tend to think of the art world as a somewhat elitist place, occupied by wealthy collectors and wealthy people and powerful artists.
This is breaking some of those boundaries.
It is breaking the boundaries, exactly, because art is being made everywhere.
Deborah and Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for allowing the space for this conversation.
Jeff Morin is president of the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. Deborah Bramer, director of the Portrait Society Gallery of Contemporary Art. Links to the Art Against the Odds exhibit, wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.